Sattva means fall down. And it means to commit a really, really serious mistake in your morality, in your bodhisattva morality. And there are how many of those?
18
what you could call root downfalls. Why are those so serious? There's two reasons why they're serious. If you do a tattoo, it destroys your vows. You don't have the vows anymore after that. That vow you destroy. So once you commit a tattoo, one of those 18, it destroys the vow in your mental stream. It's no longer there. To break a satsang is very difficult because you have to have four attitudes in your heart when you do it. And we're going to go over that in two classes from now. Basically, you have to enjoy it. You have to want to do it again. You have to think it's not a bad thing to do in the bottom of your heart. And like that, it's hard to collect a satsang. But if you do commit one, except for two of them, by the way, that's another thing. You destroy the vow. You have to take it over again. The nice thing about bodhisattva vows is you can take them over again. You can ask for them again. Jetsun Kapa says in his commentary, don't be happy that you can take bodhisattva vows over again, because once you've committed it once, it's impossible to achieve the first bodhisattva boom in this life. He says it that strongly.
Once you've broken it, Pastor?
Once you've broken it, something. So you can take it over, but you've already disqualified yourself from what it, and what is the first bodhisattva boom? When does it occur? Two things are going on at the same time. You see emptiness directly, and you have true bodhicitta in your mind. So that experience can never happen to you in this life, according to Jetsun Kapa. You can take them over again, but they're never quite there. You've done something very serious.
Yes, we're all 18.
Yeah. But, and also, when you study the bodhisattva vows well, which we will, you'll realize that they are very, very specific. They're not as general as most Americans think. They're very specific, extraordinarily evil things. Okay? And so it's not really, it's kind of hard to break them. Relatively hard, let's say that. There's another word for tattoo, which is pamba. Say pamba.
Pamba.
Pamba is an abbreviation of an expression which is pepam, paruki pamba. That means to be defeated by the enemy, okay? Defeated by the other side, defeated by your opponent. And the bodhisattva vows are also called pambas, because that's the name given to the four most serious breaking of a monk's vows, of a full monk's vows. We have 253 vows. 249 are less important, and four are very important. And if we break one of those four, it's very, very, very serious for us. They are killing a human being, stealing more than a certain amount of money, say a dollar. Seriously, sexual intercourse with a woman, and then lying about our spiritual level to another person. Those are, for us, it just about destroys our vows. It doesn't quite. So, by extension or by comparison, the first 18 bodhisattva vows are given the name of those vows, because those are so, of breaking those vows, called a defeat, pamba. Who's the other side? Who's the enemy? Your own bad thoughts, okay? Your nyomos, your pleasures. When you do one of these 18, you've been defeated like the Yankees were last night. You've been shamed. You've been defeated. You went up against, to box against your bad thoughts, and they beat you up. And you failed. So those are the meanings of, these are the words for the first 18 the most serious. So we're going to go over half of them tonight. We'll go over half of them in the next class. Yeah.
You're saying Pompa is a synonym?
Yeah, they are synonyms in the, when you're talking about bodhisattva vows. And bodhisattva vows are called Pompas because they are similar in their seriousness to breaking the first four full monk's vows.
Breaking the bodhisattva root vows is a sense.
It's very similar. It's even more serious. You know, if I break one of those first four vows, I don't lose my monk's vows if I do certain things. But if you break one of these, you lose the vow. It's even more serious. I can break one of my four most important vows as a monk and still reach the first bodhisattva for me. You can't if you break one of these. These are much more serious. But they're very similar because that's the most serious. That's the heaviest bad deed you can do as a monk. These are the heaviest bad deeds you can do as a person who is claiming to want to help other people. So here we go. All right. Very serious. Let me tell you the positive side, okay? You always hear about, you meet many Dharma practitioners who, after they've been into the Dharma practitioner business for a while, they're getting discouraged, nothing's happening, they go through personal crises in their lives, blah, blah, blah. They learned all these tantric things and nothing works, nothing's happening, they're getting bored, or they're getting tired, or they're getting discouraged, or etc., etc. They don't follow their practices, there's no life to them. It comes from not keeping your vows. You keep your vows, things will pop like popcorn, things will happen. Your life will be unbelievable, things you never imagined. This is the root. I can go over them with you, but once you know them, it's up to you. If you keep them, which you can't do unless you understand them, and very few Americans understand them, maybe, I don't know, but very, very few, understand them well, keep them, your life will go through extraordinary experiences. And if you keep them wishy-washy, you'll have wishy-washy life. And if you don't keep them at all, you'll get bored and quit these classes and say, I don't know what's the big deal about all that stuff. And you'll be right for you. All right, so keep them, and things will happen almost immediately. All right, doctor. And by the way, you can't enter obviously the secret teachings unless you keep these ones. Dr. Shenmin is the first root vowel. Doctor means to praise yourself. Shenmin means to put down other people. First root vow, praising yourself, putting down other people. A lot of Americans, you know, they know the seriousness of the root vows, so they go crazy, because obviously when you go to work, you're going to do it about 20 times before tomorrow's over. I do. So it's not just a generally praising yourself and putting down other people. It's a very specific kind of praising yourself and putting down other people. First of all, your motivation has to be that you're after two objects, two kinds of things. One is called Nyepa. Nyepa means some kind of material gain. That by praising yourself and putting down other people, you're going to be able to gain something like a house or property or money or a car. Or some kind of gain that you're going to get from it. Particularly if you're teaching Dharma. Particularly if you're trying to teach other people and you're putting down other Dharma teachers, putting yourself up in the hopes that somebody in Connecticut will give you a big piece of property.
When you say material gain, do you mean money, cash, or reputation, any of that?
We're getting to the reputation. That's the second one.
Okay. You spell the word Nyepa.
But I won't do too much, because this class is going to run over. So that's the second object that you might be after is Kurti. Kurti means the respect and admiration of other people. Particularly in the sense of when you're teaching people Dharma, you know, you're putting down other, you say, oh, they don't know what they're doing, I know what I'm doing.
Both or one or the other?
Either one. Okay. So Jetson Kapa points out that you don't need both. It could be either one.
Michael, it was a material gain, or it could be a gain in status or position?
That's the second one. You see?
The second
that's
is,
number two.
Is renowned.
Yeah,
and
any kind of gain, they say, you're hoping people will put you up on a nice throne, and you have lots of students, and they'll all bow down to you when you walk in, and, you know, like that. mostly that.
But the first one is strictly limited to material gain.
Well, those are the examples that he gives. He gives clothes, food, houses, cars, advances. In those days, it was a horse. And the things like that. That's the. And by the way, I'm going to read straight from my notes. His book is very big and it's very beautiful, and I don't want to miss anything. You got to know the vowels well. So I made notes about it. It's going to be a little bit of detail. The motivation has to be a desire for those objects. Okay? It's a kind of desire or attachment to those objects. If you something very important here, and people have asked me, particularly with regard to Dharma, then would it be wrong to say something bad about other traditions or other teachers? And Jetsun Kapa and his and the bottom line here is that if someone's teaching something wrong, and so especially something harmful, for example, you could say tantric practices which are dirty, you know, things that they say are tantra which are just dirty things, and or things about emptiness which are ridiculous and totally wrong, you're required to fight those ideas. You're required to go and go to that person, maybe offer to have a public debate with that person, and or in front of a group of people say, come, you know, could you come and we'll have a discussion in front of these people. You can show me where you get these ideas from the scriptures, where are they, you know, and who taught those things, and you know, what kind of authoritative source do you have for those things? And they won't be able to show any, because there isn't any. And you're required to be a tiger when you're talking about the truth of the Dharma, especially because those wrong ideas are very harmful to people. So that point of view is not, you don't have the motivation of desire. You're not hoping that you get more famous than the other person. You're just trying to prevent the other person from hurting people. You have to do that. You're supposed to do that. It's a good thing to do that. There's two requirements you have to know what you're talking about. You better have some scriptures to back up what you're saying. And then secondly, when you get to this point in other teachings, you'll read a passage which says, you must do it with great joy, with great friendliness, and with great love for the other person. You're not allowed to do it under any other circumstances. As you do it, you're thinking about how much you care for that other person, that you're fighting their wrong ideas. But you're not allowed to do it out of any kind of anger. You have to actually do it out of some kind of brotherly love and good humor. You can't do it out of some kind of anger. You can pretend to be angry, that's okay. But in the bottom of your heart, you have to love them, you have to be joyful, and you have to fight those dirty ideas like a tiger and prove them wrong. That's not breaking your bodhisattva vows. That's keeping every kind of morality in Buddhism. Yeah.
Would that same motivation apply to correcting anyone in any area of activity?
But mostly, there are scriptures about it that I can't tell you the details. It's in the higher teachings. But basically, you're required to do it with good humor and out of great love for the other person. And you're supposed to, if it gets to where they have a bad reaction, you're supposed to back off.
In addition to the Dharma, just some general non-truth that's causing disturbance or harm in the world?
That's Dharma.
Specifically Dharma, the big G.
He makes another point, which is, you couldn't, like if I were staying in a, it's not too important, but if I were staying in a monastery with somebody else who's a monk, and we're sharing the same resources of the monastery, what they call Norchitta. Norchitta means it's communal wealth. Well, then you can't commit this particular bad deed, you can't commit with them, because there's nothing you can gain from them. Because anything that another monk in my personal monastery would have to give me is the property of the monastery already. And it would still be the property of the monastery when I got it. There's no wealth transfer here. You see what I mean? It all belongs to everybody anyway. So. But you're not monks in the monastery.
Yeah. Okay. It says you don't need both. It can be for either object, meaning either gain or fame. Gain or respect. It doesn't have to be both.
The sattva occurs at the moment that the other person grasps what you're saying. Therefore, if you get Doma from Howell, New Jersey, and tell her how great you are and how bad that other teacher is, you're not going to collect this bad deed.
Who's Doma?
Doma is a dog. It has to be human being, you know, like not a child. It has to be someone who grasps what you're trying to say. And most bad deeds of speech are like that. And generally, the bad deeds which require them understanding what the point you're trying to make and how great you are and how bad the other person is should be someone on your own level, someone who can understand, grasp what you're saying. The minute they grasp what you're trying to say, that's a sattva. You've done the sattva. Yeah.
So obviously it depends on somebody grasping, but an accurate grasp. Somebody
said I'm a great person, and but you mean does it have to be a lie?
No, let's just say somebody overheard a fragment of a conversation and then grasped that erroneously.
How
about when you're dealing with somebody who belongs to a different religion in which they have a different view of the ultimate truth?
This mainly refers to Mahayana Buddhists talking about Mahayana Buddhists. And we'll talk about that later. We'll get to that later. It comes from a quotation in Sansadeva. But I'm not going to get into that too deeply. Mainly it's among Dharma friends. Okay? Mainly.
Okay. All right. Michael, just a point. So if you're talking to somebody at work and you say, Fred's a putz, you know, and I'm great, does that qualify?
If he's trying to get a promotion.
Yeah, I mean, you know, because it's not my head out of my
head. Jetsu Kapa says, it's almost like a probably. So that it should be a Mahayana practitioner complaining about another Mahayana practitioner. Probably should be a lie. It does say that the other person should be someone who really does have good qualities. So it implies that you're lying about the other person. Those are all. I would say that Jetsu Kapa would say that it has to be a Mahayana person talking about another Mahayana.
So if you're just bad mouthing someone.
Probably a lie.
So if you're just bad mouthing someone, if you really believe they're putz.
But, as you study the real Bodhisattva Gauss, you'll see that they're much more serious than. I mean, they're on the level of Cardinal so and so. Bad talking to Baptist so and Cardinal so and so because. He's interested in getting all that money. It has to be pretty evil. Yeah.
But a person taking the vows does not have to be ordained, correct?
No.
A lay person. Yeah. So in the lay person's life,
talking about Mahayana also.
Yeah, that's true. But in the lay person's life, I would think that if you were at work and something came up and you said, you know, it was Joseph Cuss or whatever, that has to. I mean, if you know about karma and emptiness, you know, if you have. That person has to have good qualities, really.
Meaning the good quality that's the opposite of what you're accusing them of.
Okay, but wait. And if you make some other person have rise to bad feelings, that can't be a good thing.
No, we're talking, it's a te. Te means, what's the border at which you cross into a suffering? There are many nietawe sufferings, meaning the coming close to these are countless, really countless. And but you've got to know the exact state in which if you cross that, you've broken something.
Okay.
It would be more specifically critical if something's doing wrong without being disparaging of him and with more of an equanimity.
If you're doing it with any kind of charitable motivation, you cannot collect a something.
This
has to be.
Yeah.
It's not including evil.
You could still
have to think it's right. You have to like it. You have to want to do it again. And the results are very serious. You can't achieve the first Bodhisattva union. I mean, the stakes are very high, and they're very evil. You have to break. It has to be a very nasty thing to do. And that's not the impression that most Americans have of the Bodhisattva vows. But you have to study them, and they're very. The results are extremely serious, and the deeds are very serious.
And this is only Mahayana to Mahayana.
That's what God says looks like that. Based on something that comes later. But, and they just avoid it, okay? He says probably, which means I'm sure Jetsun Kapa avoided any kind of doctrine, okay? But particularly around the field of Dharma, this is how schisms happen. This is how one group becomes split from another group. You can't imagine a more dirty or horrible thing than religious people are splitting against each other and bad-mouthing each other. And this is really what we're talking about. This is what really the result is that we're talking about. You can't think of anything more destructive to the peace of the world than followers of religion talking about it. Right. So that's not just Shemitah. There's actually two vows in there. When we finish this, I want an exercise, okay? It's a lot more than 18 vowels. Each one has within it multiple root vowels. There's two root vowels. What are they? What do you guess?
Not praising yourself.
Not praising yourself. No,
praising yourself. Yeah, praising yourself.
No. Okay.
Yeah. Either one. Right? Either one. You commit the bad deed when you commit either one. So there are actually two tzachins here. We're going to have a lot more than 18 by the time we finish. I'd like somebody to keep count.
Could you say that again? If you just praise yourself, it's you break the...
Yeah. You don't have to do both. Either one.
Even if... Well, I mean... Can you qualify that somehow?
Well, that's even behavior, right?
Yeah.
Let's say you only get so far as lying about your own Mahayana spirit qualities.
What if you think it's accurate?
Then you don't commit a sin. I mean, it's not a thought.
So you have to lie about yourself, is what you're saying.
Jessica says it looks like that. It says most of the Indian scriptures say that. It's very difficult. These vows are spread out all throughout these scriptures. He studied all of them. He went very deep into it. He had magicians advise him, but this is his result. And you won't get a better. And he disproves in that text a lot of earlier Tibetans who said, oh, I understand now what this means. And they give a presentation. Jessica shows why, according to the ancient books, it's not true.
Yeah. How about if it's just in thought?
It has to be, it's a good point. It has to be in speech to another person.
And the second part of this, criticizing others, that also has to be a lie? Or is this still, like, I have to say, this person is very bad at math. He gets things wrong. And if it's accurate, but he is bad at math.
The classic one is that this first half is, I'm a great Mahayana practitioner. I know how to read the books. I can recite them. I can explain them. I know all these things perfectly. But that guy, he's telling everybody he can read them and teach them, and he's following them, but he's lying. He doesn't have those qualities. That's the classic Dr. Shimon. That's the classic event of a Dr. Shimon. Yeah.
Is the main point here the causing of the schism?
It doesn't make a big deal about that. No? But I think if you reflect on it, that's the obvious result. And it's happened all throughout history in all kinds of religions. All those people in those religions had been under a solemn vow never to say anything bad about each other like that. Probably be a lot more peaceful world. By the way, why are they counted as one vow then? Why do they count them as one vow? Because the motivation is the same. The motivation is desire. The motivation is wanting other people's things and respect. So therefore they are classed as one root vow. But they are two. They are two, especially from the point of view of actual activity. It's two different activities. And that's going to be the same for the rest of the first four root vows. Why do you think the first four are one way and the other 14 are another way?
Parallel the monks?
Huh?
They parallel the monks' four?
No. Where did the first four come from?
Oh,
first four are from a Sangha, Maitreya. Yeah. And the other 14 are from a different source, actually. So, it happens to be that the first four, which were taught by Maitreya and the Sangha, are all dual and all double.
So Michael, as far as putting down another person, does that have to be a sort of false putting down, like saying that was really stupid, and maybe it wasn't, versus saying it was really stupid and it was really stupid?
Jessica leaves it open that even if it were true, you could commit it. He leaves it open.
Done in a nasty most, or...
He says, no, it doesn't have to. Right. Most of the time it's a lie. And from one point of view, he has a long debate, and then he says, it looks like the other person really should have good qualities, and you claim he doesn't, he or she. But when he says looks like and mostly and that means we gotta avoid any of that. I'll say Chinor. Chinor. Chinor means dharma. Nor means material wealth, okay? Money, food, things like that. Mitter means not to give it. What it means is not giving someone dharma teachings or not giving someone material assistance, Now, we got to talk about it. Don't ask me a question until I finish, okay? Very specific. It has to be a pretty evil one, right? The first thing is, we'll talk about the other person. What about the other person? There should be two qualities, one of two qualities. The first one is that they are really suffering. Something is really wrong. They don't have food. They have some kind of disease. They're out of money. They're in some kind of serious problem. And those are all what? Those are all kind of material serious problems. The second category of person in need is someone who doesn't have support, doesn't have a support system, meaning, Jensen Kappa says, they don't have somebody like, first of all, like a Maitreya or some kind of protector for them. They don't have a whole network like a family or friends, or they don't have a network of support that they could draw from. They are counting on you. You are their, they're depending on you. You know the difference. You've had people come to you and try to borrow money. And then I just had it recently. A close friend got overworked at her work, got diabetes, had her kidneys taken out, desperate for money, was never in that situation before. None of the relatives can give anymore. Got to buy this dialysis machinery. Must have $5,000. Coming to me specifically. You know, I need your help. I don't have anywhere else to turn to. I need this. And then if I say no, I broke my bracelet. And by the way, you must be able to help. You must own the thing that they need. If you don't have the money, you don't break your bracelet. You can't get the money, you don't own the money, within, you know, pretty reasonable boundaries, you don't break your bracelet. He says there are certain limitations on the thing they ask you for. Not allowed to give anything that would be harmful to them. And he gives two examples. Weapons. Okay? Like if a person comes to you and begs you for, you're the only person who can give me this knife that I need to stab my neighbor. Okay? that's where he calls it unhealthy. The thing is unhealthy. And then he says poison. Like especially if the person were planning to poison themselves and they come and beg you to help. You know, he says that would be improper. It's almost like unhealthy and improper. Weapons or poison are the two examples he gives.
So then the question of euthanasia is covered.
Yeah, you can't do euthanasia. But for a lot of other reasons, too.
So you can't get money from the
office. I'm going to leave it to you. You know, personally, I think it's poison, and I don't think you should give it. But you don't. If believing that the person is going to use it and hurt themselves, you refuse them money, you don't break your bracelet. But I'd say you have to be real careful not to get lazy. In Geshe Sewang Sangdrup's text, he often mentions laziness as a motivation for breaking vows. You just don't feel like giving it to the guy, so you assume he's a drunk. I mean, you gotta be careful.
Okay. Or if that person's starving, you give them food instead.
Yeah.
So,
but there's so many homeless people. How do you know on the street they're all like that?
To the best of your ability, you have to judge, and that comes often in the Bodhisattva vows. For example, we'll cover a vow later about teaching people emptiness. You're supposed to check whether you think they, whether it's appropriate. If you misjudge, Jetson Kappa says, I don't believe this in breaking a rule. You honestly checked, and in your best knowledge, the person was ready. And then you taught it to them, and they freaked out. You don't break your bodhisattva vow. In other words, it's all based on your best judgment at the time. You can't know if the person's an alcoholic or not. If you truly think they are, even if they're not, you haven't broken your bodhisattva vow. I don't mind, but we'll be here late. Don't blame me. Okay.
If the Bosnians came here tonight with their hat out saying, we're getting slaughtered in our homeland, please give us some money so we can buy some weapons to defend ourselves. We wouldn't be able to do that and keep our balance.
Looks like we wouldn't be allowed. But right. It's also one of your vows, you have to protect people who are in danger.
Does that include...
It takes a lot of wisdom. I'll just say that.
If, what if you just don't know? Which way do you go? I mean, if you, you know, you got all these people coming up to you in the street, you see all these situations, and you just say, I don't know.
I think you have to just check and use your best judgment.
But you can't. There's no way to know. Do you go to one side or the other? Is there any?
I don't have an answer. Use your best judgment.
He doesn't mention it. The motivation must be that you are overwhelmed by a feeling of stinginess. You don't want to part with the thing that they're asking for.
Does it have to be asked of you, or can you see that it's a need?
Say again.
Does it have to be asked of you, or is it just a need?
Good question. Yeah, he says they have to approach you and ask you. So you see the vows get more and more, the conditions are more and more narrow. He says they do have to approach you personally and ask you personally.
And the reason you don't do this is
because you don't want to part with something you have.
The reason is other than that.
But you don't break it.
That you might be able to see them that you might. That makes you angry because ultimately makes you feel helpless.
Touch it. He mentioned that the motivation should be out of the desire not to lose something you own. Attachment to something you own. The mental affliction in number two is attachment. I suppose you could do it out of anger, but he mentions that it's attachment. You can't part with the thing. What you're giving could be either material object or dharma. Okay? Those are the two divisions here. In the case of dharma, it's where you don't want to teach someone everything you know, because you're afraid that then you won't be so great anymore. You know what I mean? And it's called bhikkhu. It's holding back things that you know because you don't want it to get out and everybody knows what you know. Jetsu Kapa talks about a wrong belief that was held in some Tibetan scriptures that were written where they said the other person's hopes must be dashed. They must feel the emotion of their hopes being crushed by you. And he says he's checked all the Indian sources and everywhere, and it doesn't ever mention that. So he says it's not a condition of the vow.
What is it?
It's not a condition to break a vow that the other person's hopes are dashed after you refuse them. Some Tibetan commentators before Jetsu Kapa claimed that the other person's hopes have to be, they have to feel this immense feeling of letdown from what you did. And they say you don't break it if they don't feel that. Jetsu Kapa says that there's no scripture that says that. There's no source like that. It wasn't in it. The Buddha never said that. Somebody got up and mentioned it one night, day, and people wrote it down after that. It's not true. And that, you have to know those things. So how many root vows there?
Two.
Not to give. Not to give.
Well.
Material assistance. Number three. We'll do one more, and then we'll stop for a break. Say Shakyan.
Shakyan.
By the way, some of you may recognize these. If you don't recognize them, don't worry about it. Shakyan Minyan. Shakyan Minyan. This divides into two root thoughts. The first of the pair here is not even mentioned in the text. So you could have been breaking it all this time and not known it. Okay. In the verse commentary, in the verse, this verse summary that most of us learn to keep our vows, it's not even mentioned. And it's mentioned by a sangha, it's taught by a sangha. Whoever wrote this verse didn't mention it. Okay. And that's called sopa. This third root vow also has two halves. And the first half isn't even mentioned. So if this is all you ever learned, you could be breaking it all the time and not know. The situation is very specific. Somebody did something bad to you. You got angry. You didn't let the anger go. You held it. And it built up to a point where you actually did violence to them. You hit them. Or you threw something at them. Or you got somebody else to do violence to them. So it seems to refer very specifically to... Sopa means to strike someone.
And if it's ever happened to you, I mean, if you've ever been so angry, it's happened to me twice in my life, I'll never forget it, where you were so angry that you actually struck someone, you know how bad it feels. I mean, it feels very, very dirty. And you feel very, very wrong. And that's what it has to be. It has to be such a, it has to be where you actually do violence to someone.
What are you calling this, Michael?
The word is to strike someone. Striking another person. It has to be a person.
So the third vowel would be not striking another person.
And B, which you didn't get to.
And what?
The third vowel has two parts. I'm only talking about the first part now.
Right.
The first part of the third vowel is to just do violence to another person. Jetsun Kapa gives, the root text says, you use your own body to strike them, you throw something at them, you swing something at them, you imprison them, or you do other kinds of real violence to them.
Physical violence.
Yeah. Which, see, it gets to be very specific. And you know how wrong it feels. If you've ever had it happen, you know, that you blew up and hit somebody, how wrong it is, how wrong it feels. Yeah.
You mentioned you're holding on to something and not letting it go. Would this also apply to just being in some kind of spontaneous altercation, despite kind of?
We'll get there. But it should be a buildup of anger over a period of time, and then finally you hit them. It's not the initial flare-up of anger. How long it takes between there, he doesn't mention. Jetsun Kapa finally says, it seems to me, from studying the text, and he quotes a few cases, that it should be a person, it should be another person and not an animal or something like that. It has to be someone who could understand it if you said something to them, and it has to be someone who could be keeping or not keeping morality. And he said, therefore, it's limited to human beings. You do violence to an animal, it's very, very evil, but you don't break your root vow. Okay, the second half of root vow number three is sage. Well, that's shakyam minyan. Shak means to apologize or confess. To apologize or to confess. Kyang means even though. Minyan means you refuse to listen. And it's very specific again. Someone has done something wrong to you. Someone has hurt you in some way. That's the first requirement. They're coming to you in almost a very formal way. They're approaching you to apologize. Or they're approaching you to explain what they did that hurt you and why it wasn't, it doesn't matter whether it was intentional or not, but they want to come to you and explain to you or apologize to you what happened. You know, like maybe they did something by accident that offended you. So in that case, I wouldn't call it apology, right? They're coming to explain to you, to explain themselves to you what happened. But either whether you call it an apology or just coming to explain to you why, what it was that they did that hurt you, I didn't really mean to do it, or I'm sorry, or, I was just talking about somebody else, you thought it was you. They're coming to you to explain. Yeah.
Sincerely coming to you to explain, as opposed to just trying to give you
It says they're coming to you in a very, in Tibet it's called Sushin, it means in the proper way, in a good way. They're coming to you in a nice way too. They're coming to you formally almost.
With a true motivation.
Yeah, from their heart.
Not to try to obfuscate issues.
No, they're coming from their heart to give you an explanation of what happened.
From the heart.
Or to apologize.
From the heart.
Your motivation must be that continued anger that was the same in the first half. It's called kunzin in Tibet. It means to hold the heat almost. To hold that anger within your heart, burning in you. After the initial occurrence of anger, you keep it. You store it. You meditate on it. And the essence of the vow, breaking the vow, is when you refuse to accept their, you refuse to listen, you refuse to accept their explanations. I don't want to hear about it. I'm angry at you, I don't want to, don't tell me all that crap, I know you meant to do it, and or something like that, you just refuse to let them explain themselves to you, then you break them up. We'll take a break there.
please come and have some tea and stuff. Yeah.
What if there's no hitting involved? You get really angry at someone.
It's either or, okay? Again, it's either or. We're talking either or. Either or means you break the third root vowel when you either strike another person or refuse to listen to someone's apology or explanation to this.
Oh.
The mental affliction is anger.
There's really two root vowels in here. Yeah, the main mental affliction and why they're counted as one vowel is, it doesn't say anger. What does it say?
Grudge? Resentment?
Nesem means, you call it means you want to hurt someone. The desire to hurt someone.
What's
Nes? Nes means to hurt. Nesem means the desire to hurt someone.
But this, on the first part,
the motivation has to be that you want to hurt this.
On the
second
part, also?
Yeah. You want to hurt their feelings.
Even after they apologize,
you're angry.
Yeah, I wanted to forgive.
That's mental.
Yeah.
What if that's not your motivation? What if you're just, you know, you're not trying to hurt them, but you can't get
if
over
if you're busy and you can't listen right now, you do not break your motivation.
No, but they don't, your motivation isn't necessarily to hurt them, but you're just so angry you can't listen to them, you can't deal with it. You can't
overcome by your emotion.
Then
it's not.
It
has to be.
Well, isn't it a matter of feeling grievous to the party and not willing to accept their apology?
It has to be.
The secret is not being willing to forgive.
It's like that. Yeah. It's based on that.
Is it like being angry at all last night because I didn't make it?
Well, you feel
questions. Bye.
By the way, excuse me.
We have dictionaries. If anybody wants them, people ask me for them. I'm not trying to sell them. They're $12. They're $25 at every bookstore. We went and bought a case in India and dragged it back here. And, I have more out in New Jersey if you want.
Well, the first part is that you break it when you actually strike the person then? Is that the idea?
Yeah. You strike, throw,
and well, that's when it's broken at that point.
So if you trip over your own feet and you don't connect, you don't break.
Take care means Mahayana. The Bodhisattva teachings. Teachings about how to be a Bodhisattva. Bodhisattva means to reject them. What Mahayana teaching is it? It's either of the two great divisions of the Mahayana teachings, which is the emptiness teachings, and then the teachings on how to act like a bodhisattva. And those are the two great divisions. The teachings on emptiness and the teachings on bodhisattva
activity.
Anybody have a notebook with like hieroglyphics in it?
Fire coming
out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Would you mind saying
Tekchen
means
Mahayana? Tek means Yana and Chen means Maha. Great vehicle, great capacity. Vehicular capacity would be more correct. Four A. We're talking about 4A. There's gonna be a 4B, right? Because the first four have two parts each. Two vowels each have.
Please forgive me, I feel poor.
Reject, give up. And emptiness and bodhisattva life. Okay. Two great divisions, Sabbadangacharicha. Two great divisions. The way you give it up is to put it down. That, the Buddha never taught that, that's all rubbish, it's silly, it's no good, it doesn't help. I don't believe the Buddha said that. That's the classic way to give it up. That's the classic way to reject it, yeah.
When you say reject it, you mean saying it's invalid versus it's a pain in the butt, or?
Yeah. No, to complain about how hard it is, no, that's no big. That's not. It's to say it's invalid. The Buddha didn't teach that.
If you have a teaching where it says to say is one thing, but to think, just thinking it is bad, isn't that, you know, a harder teaching? And then if you say, well, that teaching is harder than the one where you just not
This one normally refers to stating it's talking about. Normally refers to.
So you can walk around thinking this is a bunch of baloney.
Obviously not. That's rejecting it. Okay. 4B. Say, Tarnam.
Tarnam.
Tarnam means false. Tumba means to teach. Teach false means the following. You propagate something as dharma, and especially Mahayana dharma, and it was never taught like that. It's not what the Buddha taught. You made it up yourself. You think it would be cool. You would like to update Buddhism. Maybe the Buddha didn't see 1995, although he's omniscient. Maybe he didn't know what would be good for us. Better improve on it. All of those things. Very common, very dangerous. It's like that thing where I whisper in Pat's ear something, and then it gets over here and she whispers it to me. Buddhism could not have survived 2,500 years in its pure form unless every generation, and we're now the generation, passed it on in a very pure way. Don't add anything, don't take anything out, don't interpret. Teach what the Buddha taught. It's fine, it works. Very effective. Pass it on pure to the next generation. If you corrupt it 0.5%, then 100 years from now it'll be all ruined. And it won't work for anybody because it's missing something. Or you polluted it. It works. You can reach Buddhahood in this life. You will see paradise. You'll know it when you see it. And don't mess around with the there's a certain method, and don't mess it up for the next generation. Yeah.
So what is that method? Is to only quote sutras and commentaries?
Mostly to depend on the original text.
And
the authoritative commentaries, which you can... Don't, we talked about that. That's a long story. But confirmable by your personal experience, confirmable by internally, logically, things like that.
So if you say, this is my experience of this, or this is my opinion of this, or this is my can you say this is my interpretation of this and give what you think about it?
As long as it's in the context.
As you be very careful to explain it, this is your own idea, it's not stated. I think this might be relevant in this discussion, but to present it as the Mahayana teachings is of the Buddhists.
So this is whole school going around here. Niyana, where they're saying just as Tibetan Buddhism changed, Buddhism changed when it went to Tibet, and changing it now that it goes to the West is going to be wonderful. We're supposed to debate these people?
The last lines of the Vinaya Sutra, and you can't find anything more strict than the monk's vows teachings, say, apply this philosophy to your times and your days using the proper rules. So there is a place in Buddhism, in the strictest side of Hinayana Buddhism, that says, apply this to your circumstances, but use the following guidelines, and you must know those guidelines. It is necessary to apply it in certain ways according to your times and your... But you must know the rules for doing that. You must study those rules.
Influence in anything that they're bringing in, Japanese cultural stuff, all in English with Tibetan backup. And they're doing it with great solemnity and charging a fair amount of
money. What's the first one?
Yeah.
These
people sincerely believe that they're Buddhists, and I don't know scripture well enough to challenge what they're doing right now, but I have little wiggles of words. If they're with good intention, thinking they're teaching sutra and not teaching sutra, teaching something a little weird, does this break the vow?
Okay. If they have a vow. You have to have a vow to break it, right? That's one of the requirements. Okay, we got to move. It's going to be late, so I don't mind. I enjoy it.
We're ready.
Okay. Please don't give me any vibrations like, can we get out of here? I like to answer questions, but don't give me these vibrations. Number 5, okay, Kwanjo. The three jewels. Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. The Buddha, his teaching, and the community of monks, usually. core means the belongings of the three jewels. 12 means to steal. Professor Kappa said, describes it as what belongs to a church, you know, a temple, or a dharma center, or a shrine. You know, the objects that are there that belong to that thing. Or which belong to a group of monks. It could be, the Buddha here could refer to an image of the Buddha or a painting of the Buddha. The Dharma here could refer to the books. But what he's trying to say is it's not the ultimate jewels that you have learned if you studied refuge, if you understand what they are. For example, the ultimate Dharma is not the books. It's the perception of emptiness and things like that. You couldn't steal those. Okay? The real meaning of Sangha is people who have seen emptiness directly. But what he's trying to say is it's more tends towards the normal things you think of. A statue in a temple, a painting in a temple, the money that belongs to that Dharma group, and any one of the three. So it means there's really
three
root vows here. If you just stole a Buddha image, you would break this vow with reference to the Buddha instead of the other two jewels. And you could theoretically break three at one time. It would be three. It would be three separate sattvas. So here you have three separate sattvas. He gives examples of the objects. He says the property, meaning the land of that place, the houses of belonging to those people, food or drink that belongs to them, to the people living there, or a car or some kind of horse or something you could use to get around. He says, to be honest, I can't find in the scriptures any description of the minimum cost of the thing. So I guess you could say any particular object. So anything dedicated by someone to the Dhamma.
So if you took a flower from the ground, that would be an offense?
No, a flower.
He says, I can't find a mention of a minimum amount. Yojay means, I would say that the word he uses more often refers to an article being used by that temple, like a chair or a horse. I don't think if you picked a flower, I don't think that would cost. It's very serious to me.
But if you took some flowers that were offered,
that's a different. Well, no.
Yeah.
In a sense, the flowers. But I don't believe Jeff Kappa would say that a flower. He doesn't specifically say it, right? Okay. The motivation has to be that you want to appropriate the thing.
Appropriate.
He says the motivation must be kleshik. Okay, say chipong.
Chipong.
Chipong means give up the Dharma. Give up the Dharma. The Dharma here refers to any one of three kinds of Dharma. Three different kinds of Dharma. Two of them are Hinayana, one of them is Mahayana. The first one we call the Dharma of the listeners. If you know the sense word, it's Shravaka. Okay? It's the Dharma of the listeners. It's a whole track, a Hinayana track, teachings on that track. Classic example is the teaching on the Four Noble Truths. That is a listener Dharma. In fact, it was the first teaching the Buddha gave on the Four Noble Truths. The second group is... who's that? Listeners. If you're interested, they're called listeners because they can hear Mahayana Dharma talk. They can even describe it to other people, but they're incapable of practicing it themselves. And that's why they're called listeners. Okay. Rangyal means self-made Buddha. And that's the second track, the Hinayana track. It's a whole collection of Dharma. It's collection number two. A classic teaching there is the 12 links of dependent origination. What you see in the Wheel of Life there. Okay, the 12 links of dependent origination. They're not self-made and they're not Buddhas, but they're called self-made Buddhas. Pratyeka, Buddha. Self-made means in this life they didn't have a direct teacher. They had millions of teachers in their past life. So it's deceptive. Okay, but in this life, they don't have a direct personal lama, but they still achieve some high spiritual realizations. So they're not real Buddhists, but they're called self-made Buddhists.
They're not self-made and they're not Buddhist. Okay.
The teachings of the Wheel of Life.
Yeah, the 12 links.
12 links. Why are they real Buddhists?
They haven't achieved enlightenment. They don't have omniscience. They can't get omniscience in that sense. They can reach nirvana. They're called Buddhists, though, but it doesn't refer to the Buddha. It doesn't refer to Buddhahood. And then obviously the Mahayana is the third.
So if you give up the Dhamma of any of the three?
The way you give it up is very specific. You say, this was not spoken by the Buddha. This is not the Buddha's teaching. Any one of us.
Michael, does that include any part of it? Or?
It's a very good question. If you put down any part of it, it's a secondary valve breaking. If you put down the whole thing, you break the root valve. It has to be the whole track. Putting down the whole track.
Oh, that category.
Yeah, you're putting down that whole group of teachings. The whole listener group of teachings was not taught by the Buddha. It's all ridiculous.
So this is three vows?
Yeah, good. Three root vows here. If you put down a detail of it, if you say link number 11 is ridiculous, you don't collect the root, you don't break a root vow. You break a secondary vow. We'll get there. We'll get to that. We're going to make it pretty good, I think.
So the doctrine is when you say those words?
Yeah. This was not taught by the Buddha. This is not the Buddhist teaching. If you get good at keeping these, you will be reviewing Tunduk six times a day. You'll be reviewing your own mind to see if these happen. And obviously, you should review any time you came close. You know, that's the whole practice of morality is reviewing yourself frequently to see if you came close. Saying, we'll make talk. That's number seven. Wormeat is a golden color of the breast feathers of a certain duck in Tibet. Okay. You can say that. You can say. Yeah. It's true. You can say that. You can say that. I'm getting silly now. You can say the saffron, meaning the saffron rose. It's like saying the saffron, and everybody's supposed to understand. Or like saying the golden, and it refers to the golden robes of the monk. I mean, even our robes, our true robes that we have to keep in us, are golden. The real outside world that we wear is golden. So Wormeat means golden. Tog means to steal it, to take it away. To take it away. The real meaning of this vow is to harm a monk. I should say an ordained person. To harm an ordained person. There's going to be two different kinds of harm. There's two root vows. The first one is just physically to take away their robes, to disrobe them. It doesn't mean to make them become a layman, it means to physically remove the, you know, tell them, okay, give me your robes. And the second part is to force them to disrobe. Okay, so there's really two parts. The first part is taking away their robes, like a punishment or some. By the way, the motivation has to be anger. The motivation has to be disliking that ordained person. And you say, and you strip them of their robes. The second root vow here, the second breaking of a root vow, is to force them to become a layman.
Now, we are talking about getting, when you're talking about disrobing them, it's in the sense of getting them to violate their vows?
No, not like that.
Not at all?
Physically to remove them. To say, you give me, that's 7A is to force them to give back their robes physically, to give you their robes.
That's what that
is. Forcing them to disrobe automatically.
But not, in the English word, disrobe means to force them to become layman. That's 7B. There's a distinction between saying, you must give me your robes. At that time, they don't lose their vows. And then 7B, forcing them to become a layman. Making them become a layman, like the Chinese did.
How can they? When do they become a layman? How do they become a layman?
Well, they can say, you
when have they done that? I mean,
there's a lot of them anyway. Forcing them to give up the monk's way of life.
Did you say 7A has to be with anger or 7B has to be with anger?
Both of them have to be with the intention of hurting that person.
So what did you say had to be done with anger?
Motivation is anger.
The motivation is wanting to hurt the person.
So that's nothing to do with sexuality? I mean,
no, nothing like that. Not like that.
It's like convincing them not to do anything.
Forcing them not to do
anything. How could you force someone who doesn't really want it?
Yeah,
that's true. I mean, you don't lose your monk's vows just because someone makes you do bad things. But it's to make the person do those bad things.
But if I had a friend who was a monk who had doubts and I spoke with him for an hour or something and afterwards he decided he didn't want to be a monk anymore, I'd be guilty?
Is it because you wanted to hurt him?
No, just a friend talking to
him. Okay.
Okay.
But nevertheless, it's a bad thing.
Very bad. By the way, they say here, whether or not, whether the person is a good monk or a bad monk, meaning maybe you know the monk has spoken all his vows, and you go and say, okay, you gotta, you can't wear those robes anymore. You still commit the sattva. There are times in a monastery when by monastic law, you're required to expel a person from the monastery. But you're not allowed to, out of a desire to hurt them, force them to become a monk. Okay. Well, I got away that in the evening.
Sattva happens at that moment. Of
it doesn't, I don't have it in my notes, but I see.
And the pleasure is
you want to hurt them. Listen. So like in some extraordinary cases out of compassion, or, you know, someone might say, you shouldn't be a monk or something. That's not the thing. You don't collect the sentence. Okay. I don't remember that he said. It would be ignorance, I assume. Because it was ignorance in the other case. Okay. Say tamenga.
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 Tame means no interim. No interim. Na means five. These are the five most serious bad deeds in normal morality that you can do. And they are no interim in the sense that you must go to the lowest hell after you die. You will not ever take any other birth in between. You go immediately to the lowest hell. And those are five. The first one is killing your father. The second one is killing your mother. These are not in order of importance, as you know if you took the karma class. Third one is killing an arhat. Killing someone who has reached nirvana, which is defined as
cessation.
A permanent cessation of your own bad thoughts because you have perceived emptiness directly and had those realizations that directly follow that. The full definition of nirvana. Okay. Number four, to cause a split in the sangha, in the group of monks. By the way, there are certain specific requirements here. It has to be the direct disciples of the Buddha. It has to not go on for more than 24 hours. Lord Gaukipu or Shariputra have to reconcile everybody. I mean, it's very. We can't do this one, technically, in our modern world. You can collect tremendous, horrible, next to the lowest hell, bad deeds by splitting up Dharma practice. Very serious, extremely serious. But it's not the tamme. That you can only do in India a certain time. Okay. Number five is to attempt to harm a Buddha. But literally, it says to draw Buddha's blood, holy blood.
Attempt to draw blood?
Yeah.
Or actually,
intent. Number nine, last one. This one's easy.
No motivation necessary in any of those.
Doesn't say. I guess. Doesn't just state in the Abhidharma is to kill your parents out of euthanasia. You think you're helping them, but it is to still practice on them. Excellent? Yeah.
That has to be direct parents. I mean, the idea of.
There's a big debate in the Abhidharma. The egg is for life in one moment. This was written 300 AD, okay? And the egg is moved to the womb of the other woman, and the child comes out, and which woman does he have to kill to? You know, things like that. has to be you're not your blood. That's a good question. He doesn't say that, but I assume it does.
That's the question.
I don't think. Yeah, you can commit them more than one at one time. But yeah, I missed that. Any one would be. But normally, you don't collect all five. But
yeah. So I know we're running short time. In the case of Christ, I mean Jesus, when a lot of Jews were part of, part of the act of killing him. How you said that they were facing hostages?
If they took police officers hostages. No, this is that whether or not they took police officers hostages. If he was a Buddha.
Okay.
Or if he was had attained their level.
Jesus didn't attain the level?
I don't know. I think
so. In that case, that would make them, the people that actually crucified him would make them.
Yeah.
If they took police officers hostages.
No. Wait, what are you saying? Either way, they'd commit it someday.
All right.
That's true. And if they have taken both of those connect, they'd break up the root cell and commit it someday. After they die, they take no other birth before they go to the lowest cell.
After they die, they take both?
No, they do not go for an animal and then go to the lowest.
Oh, okay.
Direct to the lowest cell. They still go through a bardo. All right. Number 9 is loka. Loka means wrong view. Lokta means wrong view. There are two classic wrong views. Jetsokapa mentions these two. I'm not sure if it's restricted to these two, but I believe these are the two most common. One is to deny the law of karma in the following way. You say, it's not true that if I do something bad, I will get a bad result. It's not true that if I do something good, I will get a good result.
You just believe it and say it?
Not clear, but generally just to believe it is the bad thing. And you have to believe it from the bottom of your heart. You can't have any doubts. It's very specific. Totally wrong. Look means completely backwards. Deny it totally. Okay. The second one is to deny the existence of past, birth, and future births. Deny the existence of future lives and past lives. If you're a logician, if you're a good Buddhist, you have to say, I'm not sure, if you haven't established it in your own mind, or if you haven't perceived it directly in meditation, but you can't reject it. Okay? If you say, as a good Buddhist, I can't say I've seen them, and I haven't worked it out myself logically yet, that's not the lokta. That's beautiful. That's required. Okay, but to say categorically, there's no past lives and no future lives, then that's the lokta. Believe that.
Suppose you were to say, I have trouble with that idea.
That's okay, but be careful. Say, I'm going to shelve that one until I learn more. That's okay. The Buddha encouraged that. If you can't accept something in Buddhism, shelve it for the time being. Don't cast judgment on it. Don't say, I believe it or I don't believe it. Just leave it for a while. But don't go out and say, it's not true. That's when you collect the something.
So you have to believe from the bottom of your heart with occasion and just the idea flips through, it's not
like... It seems to me that all of us commit light lokta anytime we do a bad deed. So, I don't think it counts.
Okay. Can you talk about the mental affliction and motivation of group number 6, giving up the dharmas?
Mostly ignorance. But he doesn't limit it to that.
Is not believing in emptiness included in this? That's a classic language.
I believe it would be.
That's not limited.
That's hard. Objecting it comes
to be. Well, normally when this happens with more virtuous people is when they see something bad happen to someone who's lived a virtuous life and they feel there's an equity in the karma. And that would go back to the second part, not in the sense understanding how their previous life's affected this karma. Is that correct?
Yeah. Okay.